You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, Summerfest kicks off this week, and our guest music writer is going to preview the lineup from the big acts to the lesser-known artists that we shouldn't miss.
First, a new report released today found that in the most recent data, the years 2013-2014, there was no reduction in poverty in Wisconsin, even as the state's unemployment rate went down.
According to the report, the place with the highest poverty rate was Milwaukee County, the most populous county in Wisconsin. But the report also found some positive changes. More families with children earned their way out of poverty, and elderly poverty fell by about 2%.
Joining us now to tell us more about the report is one of its authors, Tim Smeeting. He's the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you. Nice to be back.
Well, let's talk about that finding. Poverty rates stayed stable in the time you considered, despite some improvement in our economy, a recovery from the Great Recession. Why would that be?
Well, we gained about 60,000 jobs, but at the same time, those jobs were of two kinds. They were either great jobs like Epic, which poor people don't get anyway, or they were sorts of low-wage part-time jobs, which a lot of poor people get. And those jobs alone don't take you out of poverty.
Now, you do a different kind of poverty analysis than the federal government does. You consider the impact of state and federal relief programs. Why is that important to factor into poverty rates?
We spend all of our money. We spend about $70 billion a year nationally on refundable tax credits, like the Earned Income Tax Credit. And we spend about $65 or $70 billion a year on the food share or SNAP program. They're not counted in the official poverty measure. People have to go to work to earn it, to earn income, so you can count it for the ITC, so you have to look at work expenses. There's a whole host of things that need to be done. In fact, and other things, single people pay a lot of payroll taxes and they don't get the earned income credit back. So let's look at the policies that we actually use and see what their impact is. And that's what the Wisconsin Poverty Measure and the Wisconsin Poverty Report is about.
What difference do they make? What difference do those supports make when they factor them into our poverty rates? Are they working as designed?
I think the answer there is a resounding yes. They really help. Now, what we really want to see is a decline in market income poverty. So we want to see jobs push poverty down. That happened for families with children this year, not for anybody else. But then, and those jobs aren't enough to get your family out of poverty, then you need some support. So helping people eat, that's the food share program, and the refundable tax credits based on your earnings. Now, both of those are family size adjusted, so bigger families, families with kids, get more of a kick. And because of that, our poverty rate in Wisconsin for kids is 11.8%. And the federal level is 17.6%. So the federal level is much higher because it doesn't count these programs that we use. And we should really know what their impacts are.
How are those programs changing over time? This is something you tracked not just in this one year, but over time. Mm-hmm. Are they having less of an impact? If so, why?
They're having somewhat less of an impact. The state had a little cutback in refundable tax credits a couple years ago. Our state EITC, that is. But the big changes were in the food share or SNAP program, which in November 2013 fell by 14%. Benefits were cut back to where they were before the Great Recession. And we ended up with some policies that take able-bodied individuals who can't find jobs and tell them they have to work or they're not going to get their food stamps anymore. About 12,000 found their jobs during this period. Another 30,000 lost their food stamps. And an unfortunate part of this, a lot of these people were in central Milwaukee, and they were the ex-incarcerated. So no one was going to hire them anyway. There is a nice Federal Reserve report on six employment and training programs in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee in particular, over the past 2 years. 62% of the people are ex-incarcerated. And they're at the bottom of everyone's barrel. So you say, you got to go find a job if you want to get benefits. You can't find a job. Too bad. Now you're not going to eat.
Does that account for a lot of the poverty we see in an area like Milwaukee?
It accounts for some of it. It accounts for a good share of it. But the big thing is, you know, there aren't many good jobs in the central city, and you have to get out. Transportation was the second biggest factor. But these programs really help them. The food share program and the refundable tax credits, if you can find at least some part-time work, really boost the family's incomes.
Talking to Tim Smeeting from UW-Madison, co-author of a report out today on poverty here in Wisconsin. You mentioned Milwaukee, and that reminds me, talking about poverty rates in Wisconsin overlooks a lot of variation geographically. Where do we see, in addition to Milwaukee County, some of the highest poverty rates?
Well, you know, if we look, if you go inside Milwaukee County, you have six census areas there. The poverty rates go from about 34 or 35% in Central City to 7 or 8%.
Huge difference within one county.
Within the county. And then if you go out to Waukesha, Outagamie, and Washington, they're below 4 and 5%. So, but even within the county, there's great segregation and poverty. And it's mostly black poverty, and it's in Central Milwaukee. And now in terms of other areas, Kenosha, Racine area is not doing too well. Wadsworth County's not doing too well. Dane has some issues, actually. It's a little bit higher than average, but that's mainly, that's not Madison. It's the outlying areas somewhere in some prairie or south of town. But then there are areas that are doing just great. A big swath through the Fox River Valley have far below average poverty rates. In fact, this year, there was a bigger variance than I had seen before in the previous 7 years in terms of the number of areas that had below average poverty rates. So things are really good in up through Green Bay and in the great swath of the area there, plus the Eau Claire area, which is essentially a suburb of Minneapolis. People work in Minneapolis and drive back. So those areas are doing really great. So it's very uneven, in other words. Recovery has been uneven across Wisconsin.
So as you said, the dream, the ideal would be more jobs, better paying jobs, jobs that pay well enough to get people and families out of poverty. We have this fairly fine-grained data that shows us not just which county, but which part of a county has these high poverty rates. Okay, are there policies that work to get people jobs in the places where they need them?
Well, there are some. Part of the problem is that there's a low demand and for low-skill labor. Now, what we certainly could afford to raise our minimum wage a couple of bucks. You don't have to go to $15 an hour, but we could go to 9 or 10, and that would make a difference. It's been shown to make a difference. A few people will lose their jobs, but 95% of them will actually get a raise. That's one thing we could do. Another thing is to push hard now in getting people employed in Madison and Dane, because the economy is as hot as it'll ever be. It is really red hot out there, and you and I know, you walk by a coffee shop, you walk by a retail store, there's a sign, help wanted, all shifts, all hours. And by themselves, those are pulling up wages to 10 bucks an hour. We just need to get more people into those jobs. We need to give them schedules so they know when they're going to work so they can arrange their child care. But a strong economy like we have in Madison is probably going to help. I would bet you a dollar a donut poverty is going to be much better next year in Madison. But other parts of the state, it just isn't. In central Milwaukee, we're not getting far at all.
Been a lot of talk about skills gaps around the state. People not having the skills they need to get the jobs that employers want to give them that would inspire job startups, maybe. Do you see that as an important part of the factor? Training maybe those ex-incarcerated people in central Milwaukee to get a more skilled job.
Absolutely. You need to do something like that. You need to give them an apprenticeship. You need to give them a subsidy. You need to get them involved. If once they leave prison, especially young first-time offenders, who I'm talking about, I mean, people who've committed murder and whatever, they belong in jail, no problem. But you have young first-time offenders who get out, and they need to find a career and find something to do. And if you find them a job, then what they end up doing is they start paying child support if they owe it. They get themselves onto a regular track where they're becoming more self-supporting, they're better family members, and so forth. But you have to make a concerted effort. These guys are at the bottom. You have to say, I'll give this guy a chance, and that'll probably take some sort of a subsidy of some sort for an apprenticeship or a lower wages for, let's say, 6 months or something till they got hired.
We'll leave it there for now. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No worries. Thank you very much for having me.
That's Tim Smeeting. He's one of the authors of the most recent Wisconsin Poverty Report out today, also professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
The world's largest music festival starts this week in Milwaukee. But while it may be the biggest, it isn't Milwaukee's first lakefront music festival. Historian John Gerda tells us about the unique celebration that entertained Milwaukeeans in the 1930s.
When the gates of Summerfest swing open on June 29th, music lovers will once again flock to Milwaukee's lakefront. For 11 days, the grounds will resound with power chords, sax solos, and throbbing bass beats. Drawing nearly 800,000 patrons most years, Summerfest has earned its stripes as the world's largest music festival, but it's not the first to rock the lakefront. That distinction belongs to the Milwaukee Midsummer Festival, a free event that enjoyed an 8-year run between 1934 and 1941. 1934, you'll recall, was near the midpoint of the Depression, and local officials were determined to pierce the prevailing gloom. They planned a celebration with themes that seem indelibly associated with Milwaukee. Beer, for one. The amber nectar flowed in abundance. Ethnicity, for another. The Festival of Many Nations, a forerunner of today's ethnic festivals, was one of the event's high points. Dozens of groups, from the Armenians to the Welsh, performed in native costumes for their neighbors. Music was another staple, but the festival couldn't afford stars like Benny Goodman and Hoagy Carmichael. In place of swing bands, the musical offerings included light opera, especially Gilbert and Sullivan, an all-state high school band, and a 75-piece accordion orchestra. Fireworks were a final major theme, including some with a local flavor. Ground displays depicted the Third Ward Fire of 1892 and the end of Prohibition in 1933. In 1938, an entire mile of the offshore breakwater was lit up with flares and Roman candles. Some of the Midsummer Festival's other features might seem a bit strange to modern Summerfest goers. There were motorcycle hill climbs above Bradford Beach, swimming races in the frigid waters of Lake Michigan, including an event for dogs, and exhibitions of group and solo club swinging by the Milwaukee Turners. But the most unusual attraction by today's standards was undoubtedly the annual pageant. The producers reached a memorable high point in 1937. The pageant centerpiece that year was a symbolic nature wedding of the land and Lake Michigan. The bride approached by water, escorted by Father Neptune and four attendants representing the other Great Lakes. The groom approached by land, flanked by attendants who stood for the fields, the forests, the mountains, and the snows. The nuptials took place on a lakefront platform where the happy couple was surrounded by what one reporter described as a host of girls and women dressed in white and blue whose movements simulate the shoreline. The symbolism of the pageants was a bit heavy-handed at times, but the Midsummer Festival's larger civic symbolism was unmistakable. In 1939, Mayor Daniel Hone described the gathered throngs as one large, happy family, playing together as we work together for the greater glory of the city we all love. His fellow citizens couldn't have agreed more. Attendance peaked at 1.2 million in 1940. The next year's festival proved to be the last. 5 months after the 1941 event, Pearl Harbor pulled America into World War II, and the Midsummer Revelry quickly became a memory. But a seed had been sown, and it sprouted again in 1968 as Summerfest. Minus the swimming dogs and the ponderous pageants, we've been enjoying it ever since.
John Gerda is an award-winning historian and the author of many books, including Milwaukee, City of Neighborhoods. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and find us on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
From Paul McCartney to Pitbull, Summerfest consistently attracts some real big-name acts to the longstanding Milwaukee Music Festival.
But catching a set from a lesser-known artist can make a music festival a truly unique experience. Joining us now to give us a preview of some must-see artists at Summerfest this year is Milwaukee Journey Sentinel music writer Piet Levy. And Piet, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, guys. Pleasure to be here.
So before we get to those hidden finds that you brought along for us, what are some of the big-name acts that you're most looking forward to this year?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of them. There are a ton of them. I mean, that opening night is incredible. It ranges from, and it really speaks to the diversity of Summerfest, because you have Selena Gomez to Joan Jett to Weird Al Yankovic to Martin Garrix. I mean, it's just kind of all over the place, and that's what's cool about the festival. But that opening night, the one I'm definitely have to say is a must-see is Willie Nelson, you know, 83-year-old legend. And, you know, it's amazing that at given his age, that Willie Nelson is still playing as much as he is. This is going to be his third show in Milwaukee in the past 18 months. And the first one I saw a couple years ago was a little bit spotty, The one last fall with the late, great Merle Haggard at the Milwaukee Theater was just sublime. He was just in such incredible form. And I think it helped that Haggard was there with him. It kind of really put some fire under his feet. And for this opening night Summerfest show, he's going to be joined by Kris Kristofferson, who's opening for Willie, but he'll also almost certainly be playing songs with Willie Nelson. So that's going to be a really special treat.
Well, let's not let Willie Nelson's name go without listening to him play a little bit. Willie Nelson here.
Goodbye is too good a word, babe. So I'll just say farewell. I ain't saying that you treated me unkind. Could have done better, but I don't.
And Piet, that's a voice that almost needs no introduction, really. Make the case for, whether it's Willie Nelson or any of the other big names, taking advantage of this opportunity to catch them while they're at Summerfest.
Well, I think that's the thing. I mean, he is a true legend. And, you know, even if you didn't pay the hard ticket price, you know, which is, you know, higher to have seen him at the Potawatomi Casino in Milwaukee a couple years back or at the Milwaukee Theater, I mean, this is a really good chance to see him for, you know, pretty low price point, as you know, $20 at most. And he is a true legend. So this is a really golden opportunity to see someone while you can, even though he's still in great form too. So it's not like he's just kind of showing up and kind of barely giving. He really gives a lot to each show, and there's a lot of joy to be had.
And Piet, you were talking about the power of Willie Nelson plus Merle Haggard plus Kris Kristofferson. And one in that same vein that kind of blew my mind that I was just looking at yesterday, Peter Gabriel and Sting together.
Yeah. Yeah, Peter Gabriel, Sting, they're playing on the last night. They're co-headlining the Marcus Amphitheater for the closing night, July 10th. And that's also one of my picks for a must-see show at Summerfest. You know, I mean, each of them, what's so interesting is they obviously had, you know, great careers, you know, with Genesis and with Gleef. But then their solo stuff, you know, they managed to be popular with their solo material, but at the same time, there weren't compromises. And they did really interesting kind of innovative things and incorporated a lot of world music and have done just a lot of interesting projects, from Peter Gabriel doing kind of symphonic stuff. He did a symphonic cover of Bon Iver, one of his recent albums, to Sting doing this Broadway musical kind of inspired by his childhood. So they're just very interesting artists, you know, artists that you can appreciate as pop commercial artists, but artists you can really appreciate as artists. And the fact that they're playing that last night on a double bill is awesome. But the fact that they're going to be playing songs together too, I think that's what's going to make it really special. It'll be extremely rare chance to see Gabriel and Sting together playing each other's songs side by side.
We're previewing Summerfest with Piet Levy from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We've hit some big names so far, Piet, but let's get some of those hidden gems. One you shared with us, Naima Adedapo. Tell us about her.
Yeah, Naima Adedapo, people probably remember her. She was on American Idol a few years back, and she had an incredible story. You know, she worked at Summerfest, you know, doing kind of custodial work, and her mom, you know, is a well-known jazz singer in Milwaukee. But that was kind of her story on Idol. Was she, you know, worked at Summerfest on the ground, kind of helping to clean up, helping take care of things, and kind of dreamed of being on those stages. Since that show, she's been on the Summerfest stage, you know, several times, kind of doing headlining shows. What I think is really interesting about her is it's been several years since she's been on Idol, and certainly, she's probably most popular when she was on that show, and the show now is not on the air anymore. But what's cool is that, you know, it's not like with many of these Idol contestants, it's not like they, you know, that was their only, you know, the only time to shine. She had an EP that came out last fall called Beautifully Made, which is kind of a soul pop EP. And I've never really heard any material from her that sounded so confident, where she felt so much into her zone. So, you know, she's still evolving as an artist, and I think that'll be really great to see on at the Summerfest stage on July 2nd, I believe.
And here's a little enticement to go see her, Naima Adedapo. So a Milwaukee native there. That's a cool one for people in the city, or if you want to, fans of American Idol, too. And, Piet, you're looking at another band close to home in Wisconsin here. There's a Madison band, Seesaw, that you like.
Yeah, you know, Wisconsin right now just has an incredible folk scene. I mean, you know, everyone from, you know, obviously Willie Porter's a veteran, to Field Report, which gets a lot of national attention. And Seesaw is a duo in Madison, a female duo, that's definitely getting attention, too. And they have an album coming out in July, Too Much of a Good Thing, that I've been hearing good things about. I haven't heard it yet myself. Their Summerfest show is almost certainly going to be a preview of that. But, you know, they've just got some really great voices, a really interesting sound. It's folk, but then, you know, sometimes they'll incorporate electronic elements as well. So they're certainly distinct. And, you know, even though there's a lot of really interesting, rich folk acts emerging from Wisconsin, Seesaw has definitely kind of carved its own place.
Let's give a listen to Seesaw and Waiting Song.
Come on, baby, won't you buy me flowers with that money spent on whiskey sours that you're buying at those wasted hours? And come on, baby, won't you talk me sweet? Instead, I'm staring at this empty seat because you got someone else you'd rather be.
That's Madison Band's Seesaw with the Waiting Song. Piet, give us some advice. What's the best way to find a show that we're going to like at Summerfest?
Well, this is self-promotion, shameless self-promotion. But if you go to jsonline.com/summerfest, we have a ton of need-to-know information for you, from you know how you can get into free to the full schedule to an interactive headliner guide where you can see music videos and read bios. And I also have a list of 35 acts to see, like must-see acts, at jsonline.com/summerfest. And it's divided each day into three categories: something known, like a headliner that you probably have heard of, something new where there's, you know, either off-the-radar artists or emerging artists that you probably haven't heard of, and something local. You know, Summerfest is the world's largest music festival with 800 bands, but most of them are from Wisconsin, are from Milwaukee, and this is a great opportunity to see some of the local talent that you may not have seen. And there's going to be a lot of that, a lot of great talent from everywhere, including from our backyard.
Well, Pia, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Piet Levy, music writer at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about the must-see acts at Summerfest in Milwaukee, and we're going to go out now with Little Peter Gabriel, the song Steam.
Every day we're inundated with news that waistlines in the United States are expanding, that our health is getting worse.
But a new study shows that despite all the bad news, there may be a glimmer of hope. Our diet seems to be getting better nationwide.
Researchers surveyed nearly 34,000 people over 13 years to monitor how their diets had changed and what foods people were eating.
But overall, how much has the American diet improved? And what can we do to make sure everyone across the country is eating a beneficial, healthy diet?
Dr. Darius Mozafarian joins us now. He's a cardiologist and the dean of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Dr. Mozafarian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, happy to be on the line with you. Thank you.
Well, let's talk about this study. What kind of overall improvements did you see in the food we're eating?
Well, so, you know, we were really interested in this because food is now, really poor eating is now the number one cause of poor health in the United States and also globally. So really understanding what people are eating, how it's changing over time and how it differs, you know, according to education or income or race is crucially important. And what we found is that, you know, on average, actually, there's been some slow improvements and some steady improvements. And in particular, we found, you know, more greater intakes over the last 15 years or so of whole grains, of whole fruit, of nuts, and yogurt, and lower intake of refined grains, white potatoes, and sugar-sweetened beverages. Now, there was some sobering news as well. The sobering news is even with those improvements, still, you know, the American diet is not great, and very few people have an optimal diet, and, you know, at least two-thirds of Americans don't meet guidelines for many components. So improving, but still a long way to go. And then secondly, you know, while there were improvements seen really among all subgroups of Americans, the improvements were much smaller among people with lower education or lower income or who were Black or Hispanic. And so, you know, while their diets improved, the gaps, the dietary divide between the rich and the poor, or the educated and the uneducated is growing wider.
I want to talk about the reasons for the improvement and maybe for some of those gaps you just mentioned. We've been hearing for years, most of us probably from elementary school on, about what good food is. How much of this is a story about education, telling people what they should and shouldn't be eating, what's healthier and what's unhealthy food? How much of it is convenient access to that food, ready ways to prepare it, to afford it in some cases?
Well, you know, I think that what people eat is not just an individual choice. It's not just about free will. It's really about a combination of choice, but also the whole food environment. And so both of those things play a big role. And probably you know, the food environment plays the biggest role. At the end of the day, you can only choose what's kind of around you. So, you know, I think that we talk a lot about how it's difficult to change diets, but we forget that diets have changed slowly according to guidelines over time. And they've changed because, again, consumers are making certain choices, and then industry, whether it's supermarkets or cafes or restaurants or agriculture, they respond also to the guidelines. And so, you know, in the 1980s, we recommended low fat, and industry and consumers responded by lowering fat. I think in the last 10 years, there's been more of an emphasis on eating minimally processed whole foods, on reducing, you know, starches and sugars. And with that, whether it's, you know, industry or consumer behavior or both, there's been a shift. And so I think that what this is good news in a sense. It means that Americans are hearing the message, and whether it's Americans in industry or Americans in their choices or both, you know, we can't tell from this study, but it's probably a combination of both.
When we talk about health and science research, sometimes people say if they watch the health headlines and track every study, oh, eggs were healthy, then they weren't healthy, then they were healthy again. They worry about variations in the kind of science people are doing. Is there a baseline, though? Are there things that we really know for sure are healthy and unhealthy? And if so, what are they?
Yeah, I think this is a, you know, question that comes up all the time. Is nutrition science solid? Is it changing so much over time that we just can't believe anything? And, you know, from being a cardiologist, from you know, having training in public health and being sort of a step, having a foot in many different fields, you know, I can tell you convincingly that nutrition science doesn't change or advance any differently than any other science. It doesn't change or advance differently than physics or genetics or, you know, what we do after treatments we give after a heart attack or treatments we might give for certain cancers. For all of those fields, the science changes over time. What's different is that in nutrition, first of all, there's that's very public. So, you know, the public doesn't really notice and pay attention if physicists change a theory or say, in addition to visible matter, there's dark matter and dark energy. You know, nobody goes ballistic and says, why are you changing physics? But for food, you know, if you change something over time because the science has improved, everybody notices. So that's one challenge. The second challenge is that, you know, the media naturally likes to highlight stories about food because the public is really passionate about this. And so that can tend to overemphasize or underemphasize, you know, the science changing. And then thirdly, in addition to the actual science changing and the media, you know, emphasizing maybe some of those changes a little more than they should, there's thousands of people who are writing blogs and books and talking about food who aren't necessarily experts in every case. And so they're also kind of adding to the noise. And so I don't think that the science is any weaker or changes more than anything else. I think it's really this combination of just this cacophony of voices that are really amplifying this. And so I think that what we've learned over the last 15 or 20 years, you know, this is a relatively young science in terms of nutrition and how it affects our long-term health. And what we've learned is that, you know, it's not about single nutrients anymore. It's not about counting vitamin X or vitamin Y or counting the percentage of calories just from protein or from carb or from fat. It's about foods and food patterns and how foods are prepared and how they're processed. And so I think that that's really the solid knowledge we have now. And I would say we know 30 to 50% of what we need to know about how foods affect, you know, health. And there's still a lot left to know, but at least we know that 30 to 50% pretty solidly.
So we're not going to see a headline, at least not a legitimate headline anytime soon, that says, forget the fruits and vegetables, eat potato chips and drink soda.
Yeah, I mean, that's at least been something that's been consistent since the 1980 guidelines, eat fruits and vegetables. And of course, we've refined that a little bit. We now understand that maybe starchy vegetables, in particular white potatoes, you know, there's a lot of starch, and so you don't want to go too heavy on those. And among the fruits, you know, we're starting to realize that berries with their active phenolics might be particularly beneficial. So that message has been refined. But yeah, I don't think that's going to change. And really, I think, you know, one of the simple golden rules about what to eat is, you know, to eat foods that give rise to life. So nuts, seeds, beans, fruits, whole grains, you know, these are foods that all have are packed with nutrients and phytochemicals to help preserve a new life growing in a sometimes harsh environment. And so think about all of those powerful protective nutrients being consumed by our body. So that's a really good simple rule. And then in addition to thinking about foods that give rise to life, I think yogurt with its probiotics and fish with its omega-3s can be kind of added to the list. And of course, vegetables, given their nutrients. So that's a pretty short list of foods that we should focus on eating. And I think the foods we should really avoid are all the starch and sugar and refined carbohydrates and processed meats and other highly processed foods. And everything else, chicken, eggs, butter, cheese, kind of falls in the middle where it's not the best thing to eat. It's not the worst thing to eat. It's kind of something you can enjoy as a side rather than, getting fixated on completely avoiding or making it the only thing you eat.
Talking to Dr. Dariush Mazafarian from the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Policy. New study says over time we are eating healthier, except Dr. Mazafarian, you mentioned disparities by income. What's some of the worrisome news you found there?
Well, as you mentioned, our school studies both the science of nutrition and also the policy and what should be done. And so these findings are really, problematic for us because what we found is that, again, while all groups are improving, and so, for example, among those with more than a college education, we found that people with defined as having a really poor diet decreased from about 40% to about 30%. Among people with less than a high school education, it decreased, but it decreased from 63% to 58%. So still, many more than half are still eating a poor diet. And so, this growing dietary divide between the rich and the poor, between the more educated and less educated, and between blacks and Hispanics and whites, we noticed is growing. And that's, worrisome because people who are at lower, social advantage not only have worse diets, but they're at higher risk for disease. And this goes all the way from childhood on. So a child who doesn't eat well, doesn't concentrate well in school, isn't productive, and, an adult who isn't able to eat well might not do well at work, might get sick. And so not only does, poverty and low education contribute to poor diets, but poor diets then feed back in a vicious cycle and worsen, people's lives. So I think it's really worrisome, and I think there's many reasons for that we can, think about that might be causing this.
What's a policy solution to those disparities?
Well, so I think what we've learned, again, this is where the policy science has advanced along with the nutrition science. I mean, I mentioned that one of the big things we've learned in the nutrition science side is to not think about single nutrients, but think about overall foods and think about the good, think about the good food that we should be eating. On the policy science side, what we've learned is that, to think about food choices as just free will, like we're all kind of cowboys riding on the range and we just can eat anything we want, is really a flawed, way to think about it. The food system is complex, and what we eat is determined by so many external factors, from macro things like climate change and trade agreements and multinational companies, all the way down to local things like your culture and your friends and your sleep and your TV watching. So and the price of food and so on. So, what we've learned is that focusing on education and labeling and kind of just giving information to the consumer, works best for those who need it least and can widen disparities, whereas systems approaches that change the prices of foods or change the culture around food or change the access to foods, or change quality standards for foods, those kinds of systems approaches can actually, reduce disparities or at least not worsen them. And so, we need much stronger government policies to give us safe food the same way we have safe cars, safe toys, safe homes. We need to extend that kind of idea about safety to our food system.
We're talking about a new report showing overall improvements, but still room for improvement in the American diet. Dr. Dariush Mazafarian is with us, head of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Science and Policy, and he's a co-author of this new report.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Do you feel like your diet is getting better, or are you still looking to improve what you eat and trying to find the ways to do that? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also leave a a comment on the Central Time Facebook page or email your thoughts to talk@WPR.org. We're continuing our conversation about the changing American diet. According to a new study, diets in the United States seem to be getting better.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried to eat healthier in recent years? That's the individual level. Big picture, why do you think we eat a lot of bad food? What would it take to get us to eat healthier stuff? Call in 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Dr. Darius Mozafarian is with us, Dean of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, cardiologist, a co-author of this new report. Dr. Mozafarian, looking at the policy level, some people have pointed at things like really fundamental policy things like the U.S. Farm Bill and said subsidies for commodities over the years like corn have really driven us to eat more starchy food, corn syrup, sweetened sweet stuff. We should be focusing more on subsidizing healthier foods, the fruits, the vegetables, the whole grains. Is that part of the story, do you think?
Well, there are, billions of dollars going to agricultural subsidies. There's actually controversy about how much those billions of dollars actually change the commodity prices of foods, because on the global market, even though, let's say $20 billion total goes to agricultural subsidies each year, that's just a fraction of the total costs of foods. And in fact, for something like corn syrup, this has been highlighted all the time that people have said that we're subsidizing corn syrup, which makes soda cheaper. The thing that's not mentioned is we're actually putting tariffs on Brazilian sugar and other sugar from elsewhere to protect corn farmers. So corn syrup actually isn't cheap. Corn syrup is more expensive than sugar from Brazil, but we put tariffs on that to protect the corn farmers. So if we actually got rid of the subsidies and got rid of the tariffs, price of sugar would drop in this country. So I think there's probably been a little bit too much focus on that $20 billion of agricultural subsidies, although it could be better spent. And I think there should be more focus on the other $80 billion in the Farm Bill, the much larger proportion of the Farm Bill, which is actually spent on feeding programs. About one in four Americans are fed directly by different feeding programs in the United States, Meals on Wheels for the elderly, WIC for pregnant women and young moms, and largest of all, SNAP, the former food stamps program. And SNAP in particular doesn't have any strong guidelines about what you can buy. I mean, you can't buy pre-prepared foods, you can't buy alcohol, but other than that, you can pretty much buy anything. And there's been a lot of conversation about changing that to at least have some incentives to buying healthier foods and disincentives. So I do think that the Farm Bill is relevant, but it's more relevant for SNAP, I think, than for the subsidy side. And many other things can be done, restrictions of marketing to kids, that's done in Europe, and that's really, I think, crucial for the United States. I think thinking about schools and workplaces both, and giving financial incentives and other incentives for workplaces to have comprehensive worksite wellness programs, quality standards, simple quality standards. We've done it for trans fat. We need to do it for things like salt and added sugar and maybe even starch. Have some simple quality standards about what's safe. I think that there's not going to be one silver bullet, but I think the government working with industry can really put together a menu of effective policies.
Go to our callers now with Lolly on the line in Baraboo. Lolly, hi.
Hi. Glad to be on the show. I just wanted to share with you guys something kind of interesting. My husband and I saw a show called In Defense of Food, and my husband literally got up to go see what the ingredients in his coffee creamer were. And we, because of watching that show, did a pretty radical change in our diet in terms of we cut out, added sugars, we quit drinking Diet Pop, and we have a shake every morning with greens, Greek high-protein yogurt, nuts, fruit, like those dark berries you were talking about. And this is huge because my husband, I've been drinking shakes for over a year, and he just was always like, no, thank you. And now he is the one that says to me, so are we having a shake this morning?
Wow. Well, Lolly, thank you so much for sharing that story. Dr. Mozafarian, do you think it works that way for most people? This sounds like an epiphany, almost a religious epiphany for Lolly's husband. Is it more of a slow drip, a slow burn for a lot of people?
Well, you know, this is a story I'm hearing more and more. People are, you know, really passionate about understanding how to eat healthier now, and especially people under 25, you know, really get this. There's two complicating factors. First, the definition of what's healthy. There's still a lot of confusion about that. And so what we just heard was actually a pretty good definition of healthy foods. You know, yogurt, nuts, fruits, vegetables, cutting out processed foods, that's fantastic. But other people are focused on things that really don't have a direct impact on a person's health, like organic or not, you know, local or not, GMO or not, grass-fed or not. I mean, those things are maybe important for the environment or animal welfare or local economies. But in terms of health, you know, one example I like to give is that you can have local, organic, non-GMO fries and a Coke, and it's still fries and a Coke. So, and conversely, you can have a non-organic apple that's shipped from somewhere else, and maybe that's not good for the environment, but it's still an apple. So I think that the story we just heard is fantastic, and many people are shifting that way. And what I like is she didn't mention weight, because many people change their diet only to change their weight. And I think that's not the right approach. Whatever your weight, thin or a little bit overweight or really overweight, whatever your weight, if you change your diet, you will be much, much healthier. And of course, over time, a person's weight will likely improve. But that shouldn't be the end goal.
Lolly, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Tim in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hi. Had a heart attack at 29 years old. And after that, I started to adopt an anti-inflammatory diet, which has helped me feel much better. Touching on your weight, haven't lost any weight, but I still feel much better. And I'm hoping that he can touch on the idea of corn syrup. Specifically, my understanding is that corn syrup has some sort of chemical that blocks the receptors that tell you that you're full.
Tim, thanks for the call. Sorry about the heart attack. Good luck on your health changes. Dr. Mozafarian, we hear this a lot, that there's something particularly bad about corn syrup. I don't know if all the science is in fact or fiction. Should we just be cutting down on the sweet stuff in general?
Yeah, no, I think here it's again where the conventional wisdom just doesn't match the science. And so it's not that corn syrup is good for us, but corn syrup is about half glucose molecules and half fructose molecules, and that's the same as natural sugar from beet or from cane. It's the same as honey. You know, sugar's half fructose and half glucose. And so, again, high fructose corn syrup isn't good for us, but natural sugar isn't really any different. And both glucose and fructose, if sugar in general from whatever source, if it's consumed in small amounts with otherwise healthy foods, if you put a little bit of honey, you know, on some nuts or a little bit of sugar in something really healthy, that's perfectly fine. But if you take a big rapid dose that's digested quickly, sugar's not good for us in any form. And the same is true for starch. I mean, most of the poor carbohydrate in the food supply is actually not sugar, it's starch.
We'll leave it there. Dr. Mozafarian, thanks for joining us. We've been talking to Dr. Dariush Mozafarian, a cardiologist looking at a new study on improving dietary habits here in the United States.